I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good day, everybody. I'm more than just a little bit excited to be bringing you this episode, which is episode 9 of the Introducing You podcast. And the reason I am just more than a little bit excited is this episode's really kind of cool for me. I've said it more than once. I love poetry and I love spoken word, and I'm interviewing one of the guys that pretty much kind of got me into it. Inadvertently, I don't think he knew what he was doing at the time, but I went and saw him perform his fantastic show, The Toll, and I bought the book after that's got a load of poems that he did in the show and more, and I just fell in love with it and really got inspired to write a lot of my own stuff and even perform. And I kind of took a punt and I sent him an email and said, can you be on my show? And he got back to me pretty much straight away and said, yeah, give me a month and hit me up again. He was one of the first people I wrote down as that's someone I'd like to have a conversation with. And that was right at the beginning when I started the show. And about a month or so later, I was sat in his lovely living room having a cup of tea and having a chat with him, and it was great, and this is the result. So I really, really hope you enjoy it. Please definitely get in touch with me and let me know what you think. I'm really lucky that he actually performed 3 poems for me and for you when I was there. So that was really cool of him. Really, really lucky to have that little performance. I had a big grin on my face when he was doing it. I'm definitely nerded out all the way home in the car afterwards. It was just a really, really fabulous guy. I really enjoyed talking to him. It was nice. He's a really normal guy, really down to earth. He's from he lives in a small town in Suffolk, not far from where I spent a lot of my childhood. So it was nice to go back to that area, and it was nice to sit with a really wonderful man who helped and inspired me in writing. So yeah, I'm gonna play the episode for you, and after, I'm gonna in the outro stick around after the music. I always do little outros. I don't know how many people stick around for that, but stick around for this one because I'm gonna give you all the details of where you can see Luke performing, because he's got some big gigs coming up, and they're definitely not to be missed. So I'll give you all the details for that as well. Whilst you're listening, why not go and have a look at his website? It's Luke Wright, and that's WRIGHT, lukewright.co.uk. I'll put the links up in the Acast app if you're listening on there, and you can have a look. I'm not going to talk about all of my links and stuff because I do that every week, and just check out Luke Wright whilst you listen to the show. Enjoy.
I'm introducing you to normal people, different lives, husbands, brothers, sisters, wives, might have a laugh, might have a cry. So if you've got the time, just sit back and relax, we're gonna have a little chat, and you don't have to answer back. Oh, it's that
Peep Show. That's our comfort watching, and her daughter likes it as well. So, and you know, it's one of the few things that all three of us can agree on.
I just think it's brilliant. It's absolutely amazing. Love it. So I'm rolling because that's just it. It's easier to test the levels in the first two seconds or so. So introduce yourself, man. The show's called Introducing You. Thanks very much for inviting me into your home.
My pleasure. You're very welcome here.
Beautiful Norfolk.
Suffolk, actually.
Is it? Because
we're a border town.
Yeah. I mean, like I said to you earlier, my biological father lives in Hoxton.
Yeah.
And I always said, it's the Suffolk-Norfolk border, and that's technically Suffolk.
Yeah, way
but then
now.
As I come past that and could gone straight onto this, I was like crossed over and it said Norfolk, so I thought,
it depends what side of the River Waveney you're on, basically. Okay. And so here you are just south of the River Waveney, because the River Waveney was diverted round Bungay.
Right.
I guess for irrigation purposes, certainly it was split into, you know, it was sort of funneled off into lots of different sort of irrigation sort of funnels and I don't know the right words. And if you go down to the water meadows down by Ursham, you can't work out which one is the River Waveney because it's all sort of split up. And then it goes round Outney Common then comes back round again, and so Bungay is sort of it's diverted away from Bungay, basically. I mean, we've got this lovely bit of common land, although half of it's a golf course now, because I guess at some point somebody got a bit greedy and sold it off. Disgraceful. So we are technically in Suffolk, but if you walk just around the corner for about 3 minutes, you'll be in Norfolk. So
literally 3 minutes.
Yeah, literally 3 minutes. It's just down there. You go into Ditchingham Dam, and then you go and you're across the Waveney.
Yeah.
Because the Waveney sort of splits off down there by the beginning of Ursham Street, goes all the way around the common, then comes back again just over there. So
cool. I said, it's really nostalgic for me.
Yeah.
I'm driving up. Do you know? Is it on the A140, the Magpie Pub?
Oh.
And you've got the it's like the like a. God, what are the things called? Pergola? No, the what are they called? The big arch thing that you drive through, the Magpie.
On the A140.
That was always like a benchmark. I knew I was off the A12.
Well, that pub's just been closed down, I think. I think it's. I have a feeling it's for sale or it's just been changed hands. But yeah, there is a sort of archway across the road, isn't there? Yeah.
Thing, and it was like as a kid driving up, I always knew that, okay, I'm near
you. I can't even think what the name of that town is. But yeah, it's not far past Ipswich. It's almost the first town you come to once you go single carriageway.
Yeah.
On that very slow road, the A140.
So it's people know where we are. Who are you?
My name is Luke Wright, and I'm primarily a poet, but I sort of write other things in verse, like plays, and currently trying to adapt one of my verse plays into a film, which I find a difficult and frustrating process because I'm not very good at it.
Well, you don't know, do you?
I don't know. It's all right, but I mean. Writing a film is quite bitty. It's quite a bitty bit of writing. I like, one of the things I like about verse is you can just spool in this, unending stream of consciousness and build up a pace and a rhythm. I like the music that words can make.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not so much like that in a film. It's about structure and plot and bringing those things together. And whilst the characters are sort of talking in verse, it's more subtly done.
Whereas, jumping all around it? Or are you writing it in like an order of sequence of events, or
it's a fairly faithful adaptation of what I learned from Johnny Bevan, which is my first play, and it is a story which is told kind of in flashback. It starts in the present day, and then someone has a sort of Proustian moment, and they're taken back into the past, and then that story is told, in chronological order, until we find ourselves back in the present in the end. So it's not that so much. It's just when you're writing a poem, it's generally a single voice, and it's just you're just powering through, and there's an intensity that builds in the rhythm and the music of the words. It's a very different thing to writing a long form piece where you're hoping the sum of its parts. Well, the end product is greater than some of its parts.
Sure.
So there's all sorts of sort of magic and alchemy that happens to make a long form piece be successful, and you don't quite know whether it is or not until you've finished it, until you've tried it out. Whereas at least with a poem, you can read it all through to yourself in a couple of minutes, and you just know whether it's singing or not. And I love that. And that's the thing I really really like. But I'm also sort of keen to try new things and to be ambitious, and also I just artistically ambitious, that is, but also there is the other side of it that poetry is the kind of the Cinderella of the arts, and once you start writing plays or into, you know, if it ever happens, you know, this film, then all of a sudden you've got a chance to reach a much wider audience.
How do you mean by the Cinderella of the arts?
Well, it's just the sort of this you know, I'm quoting directly from Martin Newell. He's my he's one of the sort of poets who's a bit of a mentor to me. He called it the shoddiest wing of the culture biz. You know, it's the poor man of culture. It's, you know, it's probably the it's pretty hard to, you know, make it work financially, or it always was. I mean, that is kind of changing with the burgeoning poetry performance scene and spoken word scene.
People are getting paid to do it now for Nationwide and Jeep.
Yeah, people are getting paid to do it.
I saw your little video on that. That was quite.
Oh, I'm a bitter little man. Me, no, I'm not. I mean, I'm not bitter anyway. I just felt like it was. I felt like it's the sort of thing I would kick out against if I didn't know people doing it. So
give context on that, because I've brought it up, so
there's been a spate of adverts using spoken word poets. The one that really sort of caught my eye was this this advert for Jeep by George the Poet, and it's particularly because George the Poet, who I really admire as you know, he's this young guy, he's incredibly intelligent, he's got a degree from Cambridge, and he gets involved in loads of sort of social initiatives, and he wants to change, he wants social change. His whole shtick is about social change, and you know, that's, you know, very close to my own heart. And then he did this advert for Jeep. And not only do the advert, but he did this advert. He did that awful kind of double speak that you get adverts, where they're saying one thing and you just know that it's the opposite. So the Jeep Renegade.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, the old advert was be renegade, don't follow the crowd, be your own person, all that sort of.
And yeah, that's. But buying a
Jeep, that's not rebellion. That's not being a renegade. Buying a really expensive, you know, 4x4. I mean, that's the opposite of that. And so it was like really sort of like the really sort of awful double speak. That's awful thing that adverts do. And it just totally devalues language. You know, it's in the same realms as, you know, where, you know, of empty political slogans and stuff like that. When you're like, that's a lie. And I think there's this thing that I grew up really trusting comedians and satirists in a way I did not trust the mainstream. I did not trust authority.
Yeah, they can say a lot more and get away with it, which means that they can say a lot more of the truths, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. They had the same agenda. I'd rather, you know, read Private Eye than read a mainstream newspaper. I think that's subversiveness, speaking truth to power, all those things. I think they're really important. Like they're really at the core of who I am as a person and certainly as an artist. And I think similarly that, you know, people really trust this young kind of spoken word artist, that kind of, you know, that and he sort of writes in a style that, you know, it's not very unlike my own style, but then there is that sort of it's that style that Kate Tempest has got and lots of other sort of spoken word poets have got. It's a very trustworthy style. It's very humble, kind of, you know, like I'm coming from nothing here and I'm speaking truth to power, and people trust that, and I think that's and when people have that kind of level of trust in you, it's a very precious thing. And I think to do an advert like that, when really, you know, everyone knows it's bollocks what he's saying.
It's a paycheck for him, and it's an bollocks advert for them.
Yeah, he's just doing it for money, you know, or to further his profile in some way. And I just think that was just naff, awful, really. And I thought, so, you know, and I couldn't believe that none of us had called it out, you know, on the scene. None of us had called it out. No one has said, this is bullshit. Or certainly, I mean, you know, people said, oh, well, loads of people have been talking about this, but, you know, not conversations I've been party to. Maybe because I don't spend enough time on Facebook. I don't really like Facebook.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a conversation happening there. Certainly, I hadn't heard that many people talk about it or talk about it negatively. There's been a lot of sort of like, well, people should be able to do what they like, and, you know, which is fair enough. I mean, you know, I'm not saying you can't do it. I mean, I'm not the police. I can't stop anyone. I'm just a guy with an opinion.
Absolutely, and all opinions are valid, aren't they?
Yeah, totally.
Do you think it sort of helps new audiences get into spoken word and then?
Well, that's
and
what people sort of said.
Well.
They said, oh, you know, look at these people in the Nationwide efforts, they're developing new audiences. And that might well be true, right? But when I first saw, you know, live poetry, the thing that I found so desperately, well, there's two things. First of all, there was this sheer sort of the creativity and cleverness of it, you know, this art of the great single line. I just, there's some lines I was just like, oh, they're just so clever, and you know, and I just love that, you know, and the way it made me feel. But there was also this utter sort of subversiveness. I've never seen anything like it before.
The kind of poetry that you saw?
I saw John Kibler Clark and Martin Yule. Martin Yule's stuff I thought was particularly political. It wasn't so much party political, but there was a whole, Martin Yule's whole shtick is like, I am not part of your society, I'm doing my own thing, I won't do what I'm told. And I really like it, very punk kind of attitude, really.
Yeah.
Although he's now a man in his 60s who has some really quite reactionary views. John Kibler Clark as well, their politics are not really my politics. I think there's some things we agree on, there's a sort of subversiveness, but if you think John Kibler Clark's voting for a progressive party this time around, I'd be very surprised. I spent a lot of time with the guy.
Then that goes on to what we just said. But everyone's got an opinion, and that's
fine. And I respect that. But in 1998, they felt so subversive. They felt like nothing I'd seen on TV, nothing I'd seen on MTV, on music television, anything like that. You know, it just felt really just better than that. And it felt like it was kicking out against something really ingrained. I mean, the version of society that is drip fed to us through our parents and school and newspapers and television. It just felt really against all that sort of stuff, and exciting because of it. If I'd heard spoken word, these aren't great poems. They can never be great poems because they're not somebody speaking deeply from their heart about something they really care about. They're something that's been signed off by a board. Yeah. Even if it is something, I don't think there's anything wrong with Nationwide it's a mutual. You know, it's essentially a good thing, isn't it? It's helping people buy houses and stuff like that. But it's been the idea that it's not. I don't know. It's just, I don't think it's the purpose of it really. I don't think that's what it should be. Art should be for.
No, I get that. I get that.
So I don't think that those people are bad or evil or anything for doing it. I just think, you know, and also when I wrote that poem as well, that poem's very, when you write a poem, you're trying to encapsulate a mood and a moment.
Yeah, it's not really a negative poem.
Well, it's not what I think day to day. I mean, you can hear me. I'll be talking about this for how long now? 5-10 minutes. You know, it's obviously more nuanced, but you know, you want to write a poem from a particular place. There's no such thing as a single truth, I don't think. I think, you know, everything's layered and complicated and what I wanted to do with that poem is just sort of just take an argument and push it through and encapsulate this certain way that I felt at a certain moment.
So what's your style then? How would you describe Luke Wright as a poet?
Well, I mean, just to take with that, for example, I did deliberately wrote that deliberately in a very, you know, kind of, for me, like an old school kind of way of writing, which is a sort of, you know, a rant poem, basically, a sort of slam style rant poem.
Okay.
So that's not really how I write. It's quite loose. It was just quite simply rhymed. I didn't really pay much attention to the sonics, really. I just wanted to get those. It was rhyming opinion, basically, ranted together and put together as a polemic. So it sort of, you know, whooshed towards the end and tried to sort of add some, you know, emotion and tried to stir people up. You know, it was like a stump speech kind of poem. I don't really write an awful lot of poems like that anymore. I think the odd one.
So what is the kind of stuff that
I don't know, it's hard for me to say. I mean, I think there's a number of different styles that I use, and some stuff's quieter but I just don't really think it's for me to say.
Mood based.
Yeah, it is mood based. Yeah, I try and capture a mood, and I try to capture what way that I'm feeling. Some of the quieter pieces, I love the way that Betjeman is able to, you know, just, I don't know, it's just so the best poetry is so evocative. It really puts you in a place and with an aesthetic in mind, and then it'll do that, and then at the last minute it'll just twist a little knife in your gut. So you feel something, you're like, you know, and create some emotion in the reader or the listener.
I
try and do that sort of stuff in my quiet, my poems, you know.
I've just started getting into it, you know. I used to write loads when I was at school, and I don't know, things when you're younger, especially pre-internet and stuff like that, I think it seemed unobtainable as a career to do certain stuff like writing. You know, I'd love to have been a journalist, but that meant writing for a paper, which I didn't want to do, or being on TV and doing that. And there wasn't so much the sort of go off and do what you want and be a creator, which is sort of why I'm sort of getting into things later on now. But yeah, I think with part of the writing and stuff like that, I kind of went back to old things that I'd jotted down or ideas that I'd had, and then thought, oh, I'm going to see what, you know, I didn't even know if there was a scene. And I think I Googled something like Essex poetry, and you came up. You were the first one, and it was just before your the toll in Southend. Which was, was that your opening one? Was that
was the opening night? Yeah.
Opening night.
It
so
was of this tour, yeah.
I booked some tickets, and it was it. That was it. I sort of.
It's a good little gig, that actually. I didn't know how it was all going to go because you know, the owners of the pub saw me support John Cooper Clarke in Southend the year before.
Okay.
And they said, oh, should you come do a gig at our pub? And I was like, yeah, all right, yeah, sure. Great, I'll come. And then it was looking a bit, I thought it was looking a bit quiet, and then all of a sudden just loads of people turned up. Yeah, yeah, and it was totally full. I mean, it was only a small venue, but, you know, it was good to know that I haven't gigged in Southend for years and years, so it was really good to know that we had a full house there, and it means that, you know, go back at some point, which would be nice.
Yeah, no, I've really, really enjoyed it, and it sort of, I don't want to sound a bit like I said fanboy and stuff like that, because yeah, I'm sort of just getting into it. But it was sort of life changing to go, oh wow, you know, there is this poetry scene, and then from that led on to spoken word. And is there a difference between spoken word and reading aloud a poem?
No, I think spoken word seems to be this phrase that has taken over, and I think it's a phrase that people from outside that world are more comfortable with. It's, you know, it's been chosen for marketing purposes, because you say poetry, people think, oh god, it's that shit I did at school, and I want to hear that. So people, I mean, I sort of ran a club with this guy called Nathan Pennington in London. This is like 10-15 years ago, and we tried to use the phrase stand up poetry to try and make it sound like a more, you know, which I think is quite a good phrase. You know, you have stand up comedy, if somebody stands at a mic and does comedy, so stand up poetry, that kind of thing. I always like that phrase. But I think for some people, they're not really writing poetry. They feel more comfortable with the idea of being a spoken word artist. I mean, I think the phrase spoken word artist sounds really wanky. I mean, I'm more used to it now because people use it so readily, but I would never describe myself as a spoken word artist. It just sounds like a real mouthful. It's just like, and also for me, it's not a problem because I am a poet. You know, I write poems, you know, I write them in very traditional forms. Yeah. So I have no issue with that. But I think for some people, they're doing things that aren't quite poetry. They're monologues or, you know, so it's just a wider phrase to capture stuff. And I think for some people, it's a less scary phrase.
Some of their stuff doesn't necessarily work as literature. Like, you know, if it was written down, it hasn't got form or anything like that.
Yeah, possibly. It's written with a view to it being performed and only performed. And I think that's quite nice in a way, because I think there was the other phrase was performance poetry. And that was the phrase that was around when I first started doing it. There's actually a guy called Niall Sullivan's written a very... He's been around for donkeys. He's been around even longer than I have. He wrote a good blog on the different phrases that have gone to describe the thing that we do, and you know, he said, oh, performance poetry was this era, they said that, before that it was ranting poetry, and then it was stand-up poetry. And you know, so he's, if you want to look at his blog, I mean, Niall's blog, great if you want to understand the world of spoken word or whatever you want to call it. He's a very wise man. So he's written a much better blog than describing when all the phrases were and stuff like that. People get snooty about it and funny about it and stuff like that, but I just think, you know, we'll call it, it's a marketing issue. You know, you call it what you want to call it, as long as you sell tickets to the show and people get to come and see it. You know, it's not really,
discover it as well.
Yeah,
you know, I've really enjoyed discovering.
Yeah,
like I haven't read something for bloody ages. I love writing.
Yeah,
and you read stuff online, but you know, to sit and read.
Yeah,
I think I've discovered that all over again. Most
of the poets around doing gigs and stuff will put out books. It does seem to be the way, and there's more presses now. So in 2009, my wife and I set up a press called Nasty Little Press, because we sort of saw there was no poetry presses printing sort of, you know, the spoken word scene, you know, the live poetry. And so we did that for a number of years, and since then, like, a couple of other people have popped up and done it. So Outspoken is one of them, Raymond and Press, and also Burning Eye, which publishes an incredible amount of books, loads and loads of books. And so now there are outlets for spoken poets to get their work down the page, and some of them are more successful than others. Certainly, like, I've spent the last 8 years trying to focus my my writing for the page, and you know, I want it to sort of do more than just exist in a library. And some stuff will work much better live, and some stuff I do just doesn't really work when you put it on the page, so it's not gone to the book. Okay. And some stuff in the book I probably wouldn't ever do on stage, because it's just, you know, it's not.
So it's flexible in terms of, okay, there's a thought, a feeling, I'll create something, and how that gets put on display is sort of.
Yeah. Well, I think definitely. And I think it's mood as well. Some things are just quieter and subtler, and they might work read aloud to people, but you can't really sort of make a stage show out of them. I mean, you know, stuff in here, there's what, 35 poems in this book, and, you know, in the show, there's 9. And there's a few more that could work in the show, but there's plenty in here that I just wouldn't really put into a show, because it's just not that kind. You don't get, and often it's just look, practical things like length. There's something about the building up of tension when someone is performing a poem on stage that there's a certain point where the audience at the end will just they'll clap at the end of it, and there's that you know, and it feels like a complete piece, and it's that nice feeling. That the performer and the audience get, that you've finished a thing and everyone's having a moment, you know. Shorter pieces, you can do them, and I think it's about establishing that relationship with the audience. You'd be like, it's okay not to clap after this one, it's fine, don't feel the need to clap. The clapping is just more just a sort of palate cleanser in between. It's not about applauding the person, really. And so, you know, the more traditional, you know, often at poetry readings, people won't clap at all in between poems. And it feels appropriate often in those situations. There doesn't need to be a moment of silence and contemplation at the end of a poem. Then you can move forward. My shows aren't so much like that. There are, you know, more serious pieces, but they tend to be a bit longer, those stories.
But then there's some definite laugh out loud pieces.
Yeah, and there's loads of funny bits as well, yeah. And I always like that balance. And particularly with this show, I really want to take people to some quite dark places. There's a poem in the show, in the book, called Lullaby, which at the end of, people just don't want to clap at the end of it. They don't. It feels really awkward and weird to clap at the end of that poem. And I can't remember when I came to Southend, we didn't do music, did we? We didn't do a song.
No, I don't think you sung.
Yeah, so the thing is, no, I don't sing, but the one of the poems is set to music. And we didn't do it in Southend because it just sounded terrible through the PA. We didn't have enough time to sound check, so then we dropped it. But generally, at the end of Lullaby, which is this very awkward moment, the music normally kicks in.
Okay.
And we do that, the next piece, to music, and it just sort of, you know, gives everyone a chance.
Eases
to sort of
people
recover
into the next one. Yeah. Cool.
And I'm very interested in this idea of, you know, taking people and really having them laugh in 1 minute and then making them, you know, really, you know. And I think that's something that we can do on stage with poetry that you can't do with comedy. And I often use comedy as a reference point just because I grew up watching stand-up comedy and did the comedy circuit for a bit. And so,
have you ever done stand-up comedy?
Well, I mean, even when I did the comedy circuit, I always did poems. But, you know, I do intros. I mean, I kind of feel to an extent I do.
Yeah,
stand-up
there's
comedy.
Sort of like intro joke stories leading up to giving a poem.
But they're always, nearly always. I mean, some things do deviate often just as separate little bits of stand-up. There's 2 or 3 bits that I've got which are just stand-up, really. But they're all based on true stories, all anecdotal, and but I think it's a lovely space in between poems, because you can be funny, you can be informative, you can be serious, and there's no real pressure on any of those things, because everybody knows there's a poem coming and so we're in downtime, so it gives you a real space to play. And, you know, I've learned a lot watching John Cooper Clarke and the way that he uses those spaces, and those spaces in between poems are very, very long for him. And then he does go off on total tangents and stuff, and they are almost, you know, set pieces within themselves. And I just think that there's something about that space that is better to play around in than just doing straight stand-up, where there is this pressure that you've got to be making people laugh. And this is the thing. They are what, you know, you know, when you're talking, you're in the thing. Whereas when you're doing poetry, in between, everyone, there's this sort of subconscious understanding that we're not in the show right now, we're doing an extra bit, but of course you are. It's all both planned and meticulous, and I don't ever write those bits in between poems. I take the poem on stage
and
intro it, and as I'm introing it, I stop to feel out where those jokes might be, and funny bits might be, and I extend it, and, you know, and then the bits at work stay, and then eventually over time it sort of sticks, and then you've got a complete set.
Yeah,
it's quite a long process, but it's a nice one to go through.
So you said that you've been around for a while. You're not an old guy. When did it start?
Well, I'm 35, and I've been performing since I was 17, the day after my 17th birthday. So, you know, it was 18 years this year. So it's getting on for 20 years.
It is a while.
Yeah, which is, yeah, a long time. Yeah, it's longer than I hadn't been doing it, so over half my life.
Yeah. Good way of looking at it. Yeah. So what's that journey looked like in terms of your writing and getting better, presumably, and style and performing, and in terms of it becoming a career? Because I shouldn't imagine that you finished at school at whatever, 17.
I was at sixth form when I did my first gigs. And I didn't do very many at first. I was in a band as well, and so I was always being creative. But I mean, you know, you think you're working hard on something when you're 17, and you get to the end of the year, you've written six things. You know, you think, oh, look at me. You don't have that kind of serious work ethic. And also, you know, A-level students, and to a lesser extent, university students, have worked very hard. You know, and there was always big essays to write and stuff like that. And there wasn't, you know. But I went off to university, and I went to UEA, which is where my friend Ross Sutherland had gone. And I met Ross. I watched him do a gig, the very first gig I ever watched, John Cooper Clark, Martin Newell, and him. And I then sought him out and became friends with him. And said,
sort him out.
Yeah.
I like you. Yeah. I need to be standing next to you.
Basically, yeah. I was like, I like you. I'm going to make you my friend.
Yeah.
And
that's why I'm sitting here, Luke.
Yeah. I think I'm a big. That's one of the nice things about the internet age. Is, you know, you see people that you like, and you go, oh, I like you. We'd get on well. You know, that's, you know, we mentioned Jack Monroe earlier, and that's how I met Jack, just through tweeting her and stuff. And, you know,
I think Jack's brilliant.
Yeah, she's great. She's really good.
Everything
she's
that's been said on austerity and just, yeah, definitely. Would love to sit down and talk to Jack for an hour about whatever whatever comes up. I think that'd be awesome.
Well, I recommend just keep tweeting her. She's just a very busy person with lots of people shouting. She's starting doing poetry. I've booked her for Festival Number 6.
Have you?
Yeah, she's going to do that. She's going to do some poems for Festival Number 6. That's exciting, isn't it? Yeah. So I went to university. I met some other like-minded individuals.
What did you study at uni?
English Lit.
Okay.
And then, but that didn't really have a bearing on the poetry writing, to be honest. I did some creative writing courses that didn't have a huge bearing on it as well. I did a script writing course and a short story course. It didn't really sort of reflect on the poetry very much. But being around other people who were committed and keen to their writing and who believed in editing and feeding back and improving and not being nice to one another, not being falsely kind, you know, about work.
Yeah.
Just to say, well, that doesn't work. This bit needs to be better. You know, giving feedback. Being in that environment with people like Tim Clare and Joel Stickley and Joe Dunthorne and later on John Osborne and Molly Naylor, but, you know, and Ross Sutherland and just people who are now all professional writers. I honestly believe we spurred each other on. We might not have all sort of, you know, made a career out of it had we not all known each other and, you know, established that kind
of
environment.
That's lovely.
And particularly someone like Tim Clare and Joel Stickley, they were very good, very incredibly intelligent people, two of the cleverest people I've ever known, and they just were incredible at giving feedback. We'd go to Creative Writers Society on a Friday, we'd sit around, someone would read a piece, and everyone would go around the table and offer some feedback on it, and they were just so articulate and kind, but also, you know, unwavering in sort of trying to improve things through criticism. I just thought it was incredible. I'd never sort of come across people like that before. Definitely. So they really brought that. I mean, what I brought to our little group was I've always been a bit of an organizer and
are you a fellow list maker?
I'm very much a list maker. I make lists less these days, actually, but yeah, I am a list maker. I'm an organiser. I was putting on gigs even when I was at sixth form, and so I sort of started putting on gigs, and I was like, we should go to Edinburgh, this is how you do it, and I'd just take us up to Edinburgh, or we should go to Glastonbury, I've sent them a letter, and yeah, we've got us in, and you know, stuff like that. So yeah, so that ended up being this group of four of us at the end. It was myself, Ross, Chris Hicks and Joel Stickley, who sort of were at Aisle 16 back in the day, and we did this show called Poetry Boy Band, which was our most successful show. I did that at Fringe in 2005, and that was kind of the turning point. I think 2005 we got an Arts Council grant. We'd done a show the year before called PowerPoint, and that gone quite well as well, and we sort of did our first little tour, and Ross and I went full time, and we gave up our other jobs and worked every day and wrote. And yeah, and then I did a solo show the following year, 2006, and that was a big sort of turning point for me, I think, because I ended up doing a lot of the same gigs that Rob we'd been doing as a foursome, but I was doing them on my own, so I was getting right. four times the amount of money, which actually made it possible to live. I think before that I was just, you know, I don't know how I survived, really. Yeah. I was so skinned. And that thing's really sort of changed there, and I haven't had, you know, and that's sort of been fairly steady income for me ever since. I mean, a little blip here and there, but so I've done, did.
And that's pretty amazing, really, for, like you're saying, you know, the Cinderella of the arts, the most, yeah. most people can't make a living out of writing some verse, right?
Yeah, I mean,
would you say that's true? I don't know. Like I said, there's not a lot I know about poetry at this point.
I think you know. I mean, you know, it's about being able to. For me, it's always about. I mean, there's workshops as well, and lots of poets earn their money through workshops and, you know, running courses and that sort of thing. You sling it together best you can, you know. But for me, it's gigs, and it's, you know, if you can convince, you know, 50 to 100 people that come and see your show in every town you go to, and they're all going to pay a tenner, and you're going to pay 20% of it, 30% of the venue, and the rest of it, then you can make good money.
And do you do more like your own shows versus something like, you know, I went to Bang Zed the Gun, and
yeah.
there's lots of, you know, shows, be it whether they're, you know, cobbled together by a curator that then sticks in half a dozen posts.
There's a number of clubs, there's more clubs around now than there was. And good clubs. I've done very few of them, to be honest. I don't get asked, to be honest. I mean, I do Bang. I do a gig for Bang generally, you know, about once a year. And I know those guys, and you know, they're good guys, and they run a good night.
I enjoyed it when I went. I thought,
yeah, great fun. I like what they do. You know, and you know, they're a force for good in the poetry world, and they're just nice people as well. You know, yeah. All those guys, and you know, Laurie and Dan and Rob and Martin, they're just, and Peter Hayho and Jack Rook used to do it for a bit, and they're just good people, really, and you know, they know how to put on a good night. And
each of them would like speak in, so you know, maybe 15 to 25 minutes or something.
Yeah,
you do like an hour long show.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't really make a there's not enough clubs, you know. If you would, I mean, in comedy, there's enough clubs that you can be doing gigging every single night.
Sure,
just, you know, six, seven nights a week. And you could make enough money that way. But there aren't enough. If you just did clubs, you could make a living out of that. And you don't get paid as much. It's a funny thing with clubs. They tend to be cheaper to get into, and they have more people on the bill doing slightly less. But I find that actually, if I go to, you know, I don't know, what's the name of town, if I go into Leicester and did a club, I'm less likely to, people are less likely to come along and watch me there than if I went to Leicester and did a solo show, you know, or wherever it is. I can go there and I could sell 60 to 100 tickets, but that I'd go to a club and there'd be less, because I think a lot of people who go see you don't want to see you at a club. If they want to see you,
yeah,
and they'll go to the show and they want to get a full night's worth out. They don't necessarily always want to take a risk on the other people on the bill. And I guess I'd be the same if I really loved, you know, I know Stuart Lee, you know, I'd rather go see Stuart Lee's solo show than go watch him do 20 minutes at a club somewhere. So that sort of makes sense. But those clubs often are cheaper to get into than going to watch someone's show, and so the finances of it just don't sort of work.
I like both,
you know?
Right, as a consumer, I like going to both.
I'm sure lots of people do points. But I mean, it just doesn't work, you know. If I can go somewhere and perform on my own, mainly artistically, that's much more interesting for me, because I have much longer to, you know, I can do my show, the thing I really spend time on making work. I don't have to cobble together a set, and I get paid so much more to do it, you know. I can make a living out of it, and it just it seems to be what the people who come see my shows prefer as well, just because I can sell more tickets that way. Not always, but you know. Yeah, I always think, you know, because people do, those clubs cost, you know, 5, 6, 7 quid to get into, generally.
Yeah.
Most solo shows at an arts centre will cost 10 quid.
Yeah.
You know, and you get more acts at the clubs. But, you know, so I don't, you know, but there is a practical consideration with it, you know.
So how do you go about writing a show? Is it, that's a collection of poems that I wrote?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's how this one worked. It was about finding, I mean, primarily, because obviously I do shows every year, and I do a collection every sort of three, 4 years. So, like, I was conscious that I didn't want people to have to see stuff they'd seen in previous shows, but at the same time I wanted to do a show promoting the book, you know, to sort of say, I wanted to sort of, you know, so there's three poems in this that have been in previous shows. There's the two Essex Lion poems and the Toll, the title piece. So the Toll had been in Stay at Home Dandy and Essex Lion had been the Essex Lion show. But I figured, since I'd never really repeated material from show to show in nine shows, and, you know, there were 12 years or whatever, I thought, well, I'll cut myself some slack and I will include those pieces because people like to hear them again. But generally everything else was all the new stuff, the latest, the stuff I'd written at the end of 2015. And then most of the show was written in 2015, the univocal pieces. And so, you know, then things that had never been in shows before. So I did that. So it was my attempt to sort of offer people a new hour of stuff. And then also to try and find a through line, which I think has come through more clearly. You saw the opening night. There is definitely this sort of through line of sort of being sad and trying to find ways of dealing with being sad and sort of talking about breaking up of my marriage, although not directly. I mean, I do mention in between one of the poems it quite directly, but the poems themselves tend to be just going off at tangents. And so hopefully it's just a little, you know, and most of them tend to be little moments of where I am in my life at that moment, you know, little, you know, and so they tend to branch off in political directions or story directions or, you know, or emotional directions.
Like you said earlier, whatever takes the mood when you feel like writing. How often do you write?
Nowhere near as often as I should do. I'm trying to write every day at the moment, but, you know, it's because I've got something to write.
Is that like one new thing or is that a day's worth, and if I get one poem out of that or 10... I
haven't written poems for so long because I've been writing this my second play, which is basically a very long poem. So I spent the last 9 months working on that.
Is that what you're doing at Edinburgh this year?
Yeah, Frankie Bar it's called, and I've just did the first performances of it like 2 weeks ago at Norwich North Festival, which was, yeah, it was good, really fun to do. And I find them very challenging things, you know, these plays, very, you know, I've so written two now. And so, yeah, so that's really what writing a show to me is at the moment, which is writing this continuous piece from scratch.
And the show is just you, is it? It's like a play.
It's like a story. It's like a story. You know, I go on stage and I take the role of a character and I say that character's story, tell that character's story, but it's all in verse. It's in very inverse patterns. Frankie Varr is mainly in blank verse, but there's some ballad meter, there's some rhyming bits in there as well.
I can't wait to see it, but... The Toll's out now. That's the one that.
Yeah, so Toll. I'm still touring. So the idea was to do 6 months of touring with the Toll, take me up to Edinburgh, and I've still got, I don't know, best part of 10 dates left to do on that. And then I did my last one of those in end of July at Port Elliot, and then it's a month of doing Frankie Bar. But then I've got a few more tour dates in the autumn as well, because generally what happens, you take a show to Edinburgh and get a buzz going around and you start booking a tour and then you get it out again the following year. So next year will be all about doing Frankie Bar. Well, and whilst that's going on, I'll be writing poems for the following year, because I think I'll probably go back to do a poetry show the following year, and I'd quite like to do something a bit more cohesive. I've got an idea for a show to do in 2019, so I'll be writing all that sort of end of this year and
you're thinking
next
far
year
ahead.
Yeah, well, I think you have to some ways, and sort of, you know, to sort of, yeah. I do. I'm looking forward to getting this film, the film version of Johnny Bevan, out of the way, because I'd like to have a bit more time just to sort of muck around and write poems, and I will do
muck
that.
Around.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is more mucking around, having fun, and going, oh, I fancy writing about that, or I fancy writing. It's really free, and when you've gone from writing a really difficult long form piece, which has taken you a year. The thought of going back to just sort of, you know, writing poems, it feels just like fun. You know, I can't wait. And I do really want to do that because I do find it fun. It's my favourite part of my job is writing and performing poems. But there is this sense that, you know, doing something like Frankie Bar or Johnny Bevan is harder and therefore it is more rewarding, you know. So
can we hear something from it then?
Yeah, sure.
Do
you want to hear something from The Toll?
Let's hear something from The Toll. I'm going to put all the links up and stuff like that. I mean, there's... Whilst you find something that you want to read, it's a massive roller coaster, really, in terms of where you take people from, where you can clearly see, okay, that's where he's got his inspiration from, that's where, and they're all different places. but then they're all different poems as well. You know, you've got some real melancholic feels to some.
I think there's quite a lot of variation. I'm really pleased with this book. It's a funny thing when you release a book, especially in poetry, because the poetry publishing world is such a small little thing. I'm more proud of this collection than I am of anything I've done. I feel this is 4 years. And also, there's a thing with the poems, every single one of them has to be a fresh idea. So like a play is like a pint, right? And a poem is like a shot. There's as much alcohol in every single poem as there is in the entire long form thing. Yeah. But it's just sort of like, so you know, it's 35 shots in here, you know, and it would take almost as long to do as the,
and
as,
all,
as the one
they play. Are all different. You've got your standards, kind of, okay, yeah, that's easy to digest poems, like your vodka shots, but then you've got some real apple sours in there. It is a journey.
I'm not sure how far this metaphor is going to stretch, but I like the fact that we're doing it. So I know what I'm going to read. So one of the things I really like experimenting with form. And one of my favourite forms is the univocal lipogram or univocalism, which is a piece of writing that only uses one type of vowel throughout the whole piece. So there's a couple that I do in my show, one about Ian Duncan Smith called IDS, and one about a bloke in a pub called Burt Up Pub.
Is that what you're going to do now?
No, I'm not going to do either of those ones because I think they're not really... The Burnt Up Pub is disgusting. You'll have to come to a show to hear that or see the video, which is online.
I read it to my missus. Now, one of the things that I love about poetry and stuff like that is subjective, and you can...
Yeah.
One person can really love someone. Like, my missus is Spanish.
Yeah.
I read her Burnt Up Pub and she was like... Get that at all. It's definitely one that you have to see being performed.
Yeah, I think possibly.
I
thought
it was so amazing.
No, like, I think it's nice to say.
You use one vowel. I mean, let's go over that again.
One vowel on the whole piece, yeah. No, so I'm going to do the first one of these that I wrote.
Okay.
Well, it's not the first one I wrote, but it's the first one that's in this book. So there's one in my previous book. So in this book, I've got one for each of the vowels. So I'm going to write crazy. I'm going to read you the O one, which is about a couple of hipsters, I guess, who sort of decided to take a day trip in Bolton. But I can't use the word hipster, so I've used the word sloth to describe it. But, you know, anyway, Ron's knockoff shop. Cool London sloth.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's go north to Bolton. Oz. Proto-fop on lots of pots. Hole. Posh kook, long socks, blonde flop. Oh, Bolton's not so droll. Bolton's not got rococo blocks. Bolton's got no dons or profs. Bolton's got no dot-com showrooms, no comforts for London cohorts. No. Bolton's got lots of old workshops, lots of soot, lots of orthodox lowbrows who mop floors or drown sorrows. Poor old Bolton. Soz. Low. Bolton's got Ron Ock. Odd job bod. Compost gob. Ron's old shop flogs knock-off dross. Low cost, low cog togs. Non-cotton, cotton socks. Row on row of dolls for tots. Old promo photos of Bjorn Borg. Poo brown ponchos. Off food. Crossbows. Goth porn. Docks for... Opods. Ron's old now. Ron's got no boss. Ron's got know-how. Ron knows how to hold forth. Knows how to shop for top knock-off tosh. Knows how to cough off no-good cops. Front of shop. Ron plonks bottom down on worn old stool. Scoffs pork roll. Down shots of scotch. Croons old Motown songs. Blow soot. Blow snot. Blows bottom off. Ron's dog Bozo growls soft growls. Both bollocks lollop. London sloths stroll from block to block. Oz spots Ron's old shop. Oh, cool shop. Oz hoots. Hole, look. Hole looks. Oh, wow. Hold rules on Ron's hotchpotch lot of knock-off rot. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, Oz. Look, 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 look. London sloths blow lots of dosh on Ron Ox kosh of knock-off tosh. Oh, Ron Ox. Good, good. Ron scoffs. Now sod off. Sod off. Oh, so north. Ho, ho, ho. Sloths opt not to sod off. Sloths opt to stroll off. Oh, so slow. Ron lolls. Rolls sloths dosh. London morons. Lock shop for long month off. Roll on tomorrow. A lot of O's.
I love that, man. I think people listening should let that sink in. That's just using the vowel O.
Yeah, no other vowels.
No other vowel. But it falls, how long did that take to write?
I don't know. I can't remember. It was a while ago. So initially, I was sort of put onto this by my mate Ross, who's a great experimenter, a fearless experimenter in form, is our dear Ross. And so it's a technique pioneered by the Oulipo, which are an experimental French literature group, and there were sort of reactions. It was a sort of reaction to surrealism, in so much the surrealists were like, look how free we are, you know, we're crawling a horse bigger than a house. The Oulipo were like, no, you're not free, you're just obeying rules that you don't understand. In order to truly free the subconscious, you must place the mind in constraints and force you to dig deeper into it, which is an interesting way of looking at it, a nice theory. I was sort of aware of it because I used to teach this John Cuba Clarke poem called The Pest, which is an entirely alliterative poem, and I've written my own alliterative poems, which are nearly all just beginning with one letter. And it does, you can't control where the narrative's going to go at all, really. You have to just fling it together best you can, and it does do something. There is, you know, where the story actually comes from, you have no idea. You don't go, because mostly your poem will be like, I want to write about such and such, or this is a great line, I wonder where it'll lead me, or I have this feeling, or I have this image in my mind and I want to try and bring that to life. Titles are great, some sort of start point. But
that's what I don't get with these vowel ones.
Yeah, you don't have it. You just have to start writing so you get something. And then it just sparks another idea, and it sparks another, and it's total idea spark, and it's just sort of great fun. And what you end up with is it does tend to say something about the way you look at the world. So then there I've got a couple of sort of privileged people being ripped off and embarrassed by a sort of canny, less privileged person. It's pretty black and white. It's pretty obvious, and it's very nuanced. But it's meant to just be a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, and I think, sort of put that sort of, wow. And I don't even know what, anyway, when I first wrote it, I used I used Y, because that's how we always did them. And the Oulipo were always like, you can't use Y, Y is a vowel.
Okay.
I mean, we don't see it as a vowel in English, but it does perform the role of a vowel. In French, which is what they're originally writing in the Oulipo, that it's very much considered a vowel.
Yeah.
So Ross and Joe and Tim, who had done the initial sort of univocalisms, went to an Oulipo meeting and they got sort of hounded out of there for using Y. And their philosophy was always like, you can't do it without Y, the poems would be shit. It's just too restrictive. So I first wrote that with Y. So stuff like, go north and Bolton, footy town, not one for months now, is one of the lines that I had to lose, unfortunately. And then it was only like 18 months ago, I did a gig with Mark Grist, and Mark had written a univocalism and did this univocalism which he used Y.
Mark Grist.
And so I just dug this one out of my laptop, and I was like, oh, I'm going to read this, if you've done one. And then it just was bugging me. I was thinking, do you know what, the Y does really ruin it, ruins the purity of the sound. I'm really into sound is a big thing for me.
And I was like, every time you have a Y word, it just spoils it, you know. And it does make it easier. And I was like, I bet I could. So I translated this from a univocalism using Y. I took all the Ys out, and I was like, yeah, it would kind of work. So from there, I went on to write the other four, thinking, yeah, I'm just going to take Y out of this.
So that's the first one you wrote.
So, well, this is the second one. I wrote one in E before that, but I think using the odd Y in E is fine because the Y is making an E sound. So
yeah,
I think
sure.
So for me, it's about the sound purity. Although, I mean, in here, I've got growl. And I've got Bjorn Borg, and that's kind of cheating because you know the J and the W are sort of performing, are changing sounds of the vowels. But I allowed myself that. It's all about making your own decisions, really. But I don't know where I start. But yeah, I think I can't remember. I didn't have sloths originally, but go north to Bolton. I just had that line, and you know, cool London sloths or whatever I had before that, go north to Bolton. And I was like, that's quite an interesting line, isn't it? You know, two guys from London go to Bolton. You know, you immediately have a tension there, so that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
So that's just that's your kicking off point.
Love it.
So I don't really know how other things went. I mean, this one.
So you're not going to do, but
I'll do IDS for you though, because it would be interesting.
Do a contrasting one.
Yeah,
if
yeah,
you
I'll
can.
Do. Yeah,
because
yeah,
I want
sure.
people to go and see the show, and because I think some of these.
Yeah,
ones,
I'm happy
need,
to do IDS. I won't do, but I think I do. But I just think
no,
it's you need a bit of
see.
Space.
Yeah.
So IDS. This is about Ian Duncan Smith, who, for the uninitiated, was Work and Pension Secretary for 6 years, in Cameron's cabinet. And previously been leader of the Conservative Party, and is, you know, obviously sees himself as a sort of social reformer, but has made some kind of, I think, kind of, you know, hard decisions, and a lot of that there's been an ideological drive to shrink the state, and it's had a really awful effect on people and benefits for various reasons. And there's a company called Atos, not Asos. Asos is the clothing company.
Yeah.
A different Atos, who they, you know, French firm which they what's the word I'm looking for? They outsourced the work to. And I've got a friend who's got rheumatoid arthritis. I mean, he's bedbound on a number of days, and they tried to stop his benefits. It also happens he's a clever, university-educated man who knows how to stick up for himself, and has got good support of people around him, and was able to appeal and to get together a court appeal, which was incredibly stressful.
But a lot of people just don't have,
and a lot of people don't
that,
have
do
that. You know,
yeah.
they, let's be honest. You know, a lot of people they receive a form saying we're cutting your benefits, just don't know where they even fucking begin.
Yeah.
You know, and this, you know, this has been, this is something that's been happening over Britain. So anyway, so I kind of thought, well, I wanted to write about Ian Duncan Smith in some way, and I wanted it to be a sort of feisty, kind of punky, kind of sort of thing. And so I thought, I'll see if I can write about him using only one vowel. And obviously, there's an immediate problem in that. It's more than one vowel in his name alone. So, but also, he's also known by his initials, IDS. So again, I'm slightly ruining the sound because IDS, but I mean, they're only words, so technically I can get away with it. So I thought, so I started writing this piece, and I thought, well, I'll read the piece and I'll talk about it afterwards. But yeah, IDS for Ian Duncan Smith. Look, can I still, because, you know, satire, I thought maybe it'd be a comment on satire itself, the idea that, you know, sometimes as a satirist, you feel very sort of, you know, limited writing a poem.
Yeah.
Having a go, well, that's not going to change the world, is it? So I thought, actually, if you take all the vowels out and make it even harder for yourself, it sort of makes a comment on the very nature of satire itself and its
kind of
nature. I also just figured that it'd be such a difficult thing to do, that the fact that it's a very, not a very new thing to be having a go at Ian Duncan Smith. Of course, I wrote this poem and about 3 months later he resigned as well. So I like to think the poem did it. But yeah, anyway, IDS. This is IDS. This swinish thin grin spilling cringing scripts is IDS. This priggish birch whip. This piss dripping fright witch with whitish skin wig. This jiggling tit hitting skint Brits in mining districts. This grim Christ victimising sick kids with dwindling tit bits. This is IDS. Mimicking kings, ripping ribs in glitz grills, licking his lips, thinking this is bliss, piling it high, sipping his gin fizz whilst Brits flinch in wind chill, sticking pins in him. This is IDS, inking his list,
kids, girls with six kids, inciting right-wing print kingpins hissing pish, stirring fright, twisting victims till victims stink, till victims swim in ill will, till British dimwits drift right. This is IDS. I wish him midnight shifts. I wish him sinking ships. I wish him limp dicks. I wish him ship picnics in drizzling mist with ISIS. I wish him blind with hindsight. I wish him illicit kinship with pigs. So,
I love that.
Well, I just like, I love the way it forces you to create euphemism, and then you find there was that thing that he had, that £50 breakfast or whatever, which the taxpayer paid for. So, you know, mimicking kings, ripping ribs in glitz grills. This idea of him is this sort of Henry VIII type thing. sipping his gin fizz, thinking this is bliss. You know, you're sort of finding whatever you can, whilst Brits flinch in wind chill, sticking pins. So, you know, I'd never write a line like that if I had all the vowels there. But, you know, that went to blow my own trumpet. I think whilst Brits flinch in wind chill, sticking pins in him, I think it's just an evocative line. It's so much better than anything I would have come up with had I not. And I think these poems, they do. I think there's... I don't remember writing these univocalisms. I know that I did, but I don't remember the writing process. What I remember about this is I wrote one verse and thought, I won't be able to carry this on. There's no way I'll get to a satisfactory ending.
I would have thought that had been such a painful process, it would have been hard to forget.
It was, but you know what? I wrote this IDS poem, I wrote it in about 2 hours. It was just much less than it just was coming at this point. It was just flowing. I think because I'd written an A1 by this point, I'd written an O1, I'd written a U1. It was just sort of, I thought, can I keep this up? I'll never be. And there's another poem in my first book called Houses That Used to Be Boozers, which has got a very tight rhyme. I'll probably read it in a bit because it's one of my favourites, and it's very tightly rhymed. And I sort of started that, and I thought, I'm never going to be able to maintain this form. It's too much. It requires too much rhyming. I'm never going to be able to make sense out of it.
Yeah.
And actually, it's telling that when you try something and think, I won't be able to keep this up, is exactly those moments when you do keep it up. And when you get to the end of it, it's some of the best stuff you've written. So I love the way that form does that. All form does that. But those extreme forms really push you into creating something that not only sounds great, but it necessity is the mother of invention. I had to find a way of saying those things in that way, and so I found, you know, much more interesting ways. And I'm not a very I couldn't write surrealist sort of poetry. I've got a friend, a guy called Luke Kennard, and he's a fabulous surreal poet. I mean, he's the star. I couldn't do that. His imagination, just the places he takes, the metaphor, the places he takes you to, just kind of blow my mind. I couldn't do that. And so I use form to sort of push me away from pedestrian language, which is where I naturally want to go to. I'm a big believer in cliche, and I think that some of the most powerful poems is when you can end on a fairly cliched line, but to have earned the cliche.
Right.
You know, the ultimate is to end a poem saying I love you, and to have earned that in some way. I mean, I don't think it's possible to do that, to make it an interesting line. But it's just those, you know, because actually those simple lines that we all know,
yeah,
and all associate with our own lives, those are the ones that will twist your heartstrings at the last moment and make make people cry. And
Mike Garry did that for me when I.
Mike Garry's an expert at that.
From start to finish, you take
any line out of a Mike Garry poem, you're like, but there's something about some of their parts. Yeah. You got it makes you feel. He's very good at doing that, particularly live. You know, he really sells it to you. But I think there's, you know, but I like that thing of being able to sort of earn a pedestrian, you know, a line that feels quite pat, you know,
yeah,
but by placing it at the end of some other lines that take you in an interesting place, you've kind of earned it, I think. Yeah,
so that was from the Toll, the show that you're touring at the moment, the book that's out and people can grab, and I highly recommend doing both the book and the show, especially for ones like Bar Pub. But the Toll comes from the Dartford Toll,
yeah,
a fair way away from here.
Where was the inspiration for that?
I was just, well, I've, you know, like any good southerner, I've spent my time, I put my time in queuing for the Dartford toll. Because you don't queue anymore now, they've replaced it all with cameras, so it is better
off. Yeah, but, I don't think it is, because I've just got a fine through the post, because you go out on a Sunday, you have a nice day.
Yeah, no, don't talk to me, I've been fined so many times, and now I'm signed up, and now I have to think about it.
Yeah.
You've got to sign up, you give me your number plate, and then it just takes it out of your bank account if you go through. So I go through the Dartford toll probably two or three times a week because my girlfriend lives in Brighton. I make the journey from here to Brighton, which is almost exactly 3 hours on the nose, and I'm making it today. I do it all the time. And I used to be, and Simon, you want to talk to Simon Day about this? He's very cross about the Dartford toll. He's never paid any of it. He reckons he's got in the hundreds of fines and he's ignored them all. Oh, I can't remember to pay it, he says. There used to be this thing where you queue up. There was the Great British tradition of queuing to get into the tunnel. And one day I just went through and I paid my money to this woman in the toll booth. And I just had this sort of thought, you know. I thought, I'm really drawn to these non-spaces. I mean, me and the guys wrote a show about service stations. I've always written about motorways and roads. And so I was, when you're sort of stopped on the carriageway and you realise how big it is, how wide a motorway is. It's this massive space, but you'd never walk on it. No one ever walks on a motorway.
Yeah.
They're really inhospitable places. And I just looked at this woman sitting in this toll booth and thought, my God, imagine working here in this crowd. Well, these cars, and it's terrifying. The cars go, if you've ever stood next to a busy road, it's a really terrifying experience, really dangerous.
Yeah.
And imagine working in the middle of all that. It's a very hostile, non-place. And I just wrote down Toll Booth Tracy. And it just sounded like a real sort of, I just like the idea of writing about a toll booth. I like the alliteration. It just made me think of a Blur song, sort of thing Damon Albarn would have written them in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
That's all I had. A Toll Booth Tracy. I had it. I found it, actually, a note of it. It must be the end of 2013. And it wasn't until the summer of 2014. I started to formulate this story in my head that she was, looking for an escape and the idea of toll. It just all sort of layered those ideas. And in the end, I sort of wrote this story about this woman who grows up with a mother who's an alcoholic, although that's not immediately obvious. It's sort of hinted at until about two-thirds of the way through the poem. And the decision she decides to make, which is not to immediately get out when she hits 16, but to actually stay around and help her mum, even though her mum never helps her. And that sense of duty one has as a family member. And I sort of, only after I'd written it, performed it a few times, I started thinking, well, where's that come from?
What was that story? Yeah, where's the creation of this character come from?
Well, it was a subconscious one, but actually I think it's come from my own mother who her being the Tracy character, because my mum grew up in Zimbabwe and her parents put her in a children's home when she was six. And it was because, from what I understand, is that her dad was an alcoholic and was violent towards her mother. And her mother couldn't cope. But the parents stayed together. So my mum's parents stayed together, had three more children, all of which they gave away to the state. And my mum, when she was 18, traced her mum back to England. Her mum moved back to England by this point. And my mum moved across here. Well, she was 21. She moved across here and she went and sought her out in St Albans, and she stayed with her for a bit and tried to establish some kind of relationship with her. And then when my nan died, we used to go see my nanny once in a while, but I was never particularly close to her. But my mum would go and she would take us, and we'd go every sort of year or every couple of three times a year.
Sure.
And then when she died, I remember it, we'd been on holiday. I must have been about 7 or 8, maybe 9, I don't know. And we came back and there was a message on our answer phone saying that, your mum's died. And I remember saying, "Oh, I'm really sorry, Mum." Because I didn't know really. I knew Mum at that
point. You had the natural reaction.
Yeah, I remember thinking, "Oh, that must be really hard for my mum." My mum went, "Well, she says it's just me." And there was this sort of sense of resignation of like, "Well, of course she's died," and it's happened. There's a lovely line in the Mountain Goats. I don't know if you know the Mountain Goats stuff. They're really one of my favourite bands, but there's it's a line and he says, he's talking about his abusive stepfather, and he says, when my sister rung last fall to tell me that you died at last,
at last. Sada, you died at last. And what you mean by at last is per... I mean, it's not that for my mum, and there wasn't a hatred or anything like that. But then my mum went up to St Albans and she cleared out my nan's flat and did all the you know, the all the sort of... what's the line I use in the poem? Or something, but the, you know, the deathly duties or... No, it's,
oh, yeah.
It's a sort of play on deathly boring and deathly... yeah. All the deathly admin, that's what I mean, yeah. Yeah, she did all that stuff, you know, which is a nightmare, you know, in admin when someone dies. She did all that stuff. And there's that sort of sense of duty, well, you know, I'm going to do this. And I think it must be an incredibly... I imagine it must have been an incredibly freeing thing in a way, yeah, to have done that. And I to behave in the way that not someone deserves, but in the way that you that is true to yourself and is the best way to be the best person you can. And I've felt that at a few times in my life, that I've sort of wanted to do one thing. I think, well, this person is, you know, and you've checked yourself and go, no, I'm going to do this because I think this is the right thing to do.
Sure, yeah.
And to be governed by your own moral code and not one that's been foisted upon you by someone else who's behaving not as well as they could do. And I think actually what it gives you is this immense sense of peace, I think, in a way. And that's what I wanted to get, and I guess that's kind of what that poem is. And that's really, having written that poem, thought about it and gone, oh, do you know what, I think that's where that came from. It was really interesting about how, again, your subconscious works.
The sense of duty really kind of resonated with me, because like I said, it's quite nostalgic driving up here today. Yeah. Because I'm going past pretty much the roads that,
yeah,
would take me within 5 minutes to my dad's house. I live 2 hours away from here, so I don't, yeah, do that journey,
yeah,
often. You know, and I haven't seen or spoken to him for quite a while now. But he's going to die, of course. And I get that, what you said, as you said, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's will there be that sense of duty come into play for me? It's sort of,
yeah,
yeah.
The relationship, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've had an excellent relationship with my parents. My parents are great, good, decent, kind people who've, you know, who've done everything for me, and so I'm very fortunate. And you know, I didn't grow up with the kind of life that Tracy did, but I've known people who have,
yeah,
a number of people who I care deeply about, so I'm aware of that. And again, there was this thing with my mum as well, so yeah, so it ended up being that kind of story about people really struggling in a difficult situation, and hopefully being sympathetic to everyone in that situation and trying to paint a realistic picture. But yeah, I don't know where, you know, but then that's one thing, but then, you know, I mean, you know, a thousand TV programs and films and poems and books I've read, it all feeds into your understanding of a situation when you're not writing directly about your own life. You know, it's influences taken from you. People go, where'd you get your ideas from? Where'd you get influence from? Literally everything that I've ever
do you say, sort of like an equal measure, things that you see and witness from other people and things that directly are happening in your life? So you, like you mentioned earlier, divorced.
Yeah.
I know you've got two sons. Yeah. So, I mean, do you write a lot about family life and things like that as well?
Yeah, I have done, and that's pretty much directly influenced by the things I've experienced. But also, yeah, when I'm creating characters, I am imagining, and I'm sure some of that stuff's coming from books and films and other poems and other things like that. And some of it, you know, just comes from the language itself, the language, you know. So when you're using form, so, you know, in The Toll, the poem we've been talking about, you know, there's it's written in ballad meter, a sort of version of ballad meter, where there are three right, so it's da-dum, 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 ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. So that's every, that's, you know, this, and three of those, so it went each rhyming at the end. So, you know, it's quite a tricky thing to be telling a narrative and having to make it rhyme and also take the story in the right direction. So sometimes details and little things can just be sometimes put there because of a rhyme, and not just, you know, they have to work as well, but you know, you go, oh, what rhymes with that? Oh, that rhymes with that. Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah, maybe you can have that colour hair, or maybe they can live in that place, or maybe they can have, you know, this thing, or maybe this can be, you know, the way she looks, you know, maybe she can have, you know, a curls, or, you know, or whatever, I don't know, you know. And then that actually becomes quite a significant image in the poem, and it's only there because you've forced to find a different way of saying something. And so I think that's why I like using form, because it just takes you in really interesting places that, I mean, you know, I don't talk in a particularly interesting or poetic way when I'm just chatting to people. But yeah, well, I could, you know, so my natural inclination is to write in cliches and talk the rest of us do. And so form just helps me forces me to go in other directions, forces me to be interesting.
And like you said, with, you know, a couple of the lines that if you hadn't been forced into that situation, you'd have never created
it. Never would have created it. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, when you've got an infinite choice of what to say next, it's very hard to try and settle on what
it's
you
like
can
being
do.
It's like a buffet, isn't it?
Yeah. So it just narrows it down. Yeah, exactly. And you're in a buffet, you end up overfilling your plate and feeling a bit sick, you know. But if you're limited for choice, it sort of makes you sort of make the most of what you've got.
Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
I really like that.
So before we wrap up, because I've got to drive back to Essex.
Yeah, you've got to go to Essex, and I've got to vote,
because it's possibly end of May Day, isn't it?
It is election
today,
day.
You've
today
already done yours, but you've got to drive to Brighton.
I've got to drive to Brighton. Well, yeah, I'm choosing to drive to Brighton because I'm going to sit up and watch the election with my partner Rosie and our good friend James and Rosie's daughter Olive. I wonder how long Olive will last before she has to go to bed. Probably not very long.
So
after.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, so that you can get on and do that and. You know, thanks very much for the time, but you said you was going to read us another one.
Yeah, alright, I'll do your houses that used to be boozers, which is one of my favourites, which is about pubs, and all the pubs are being closed down, and it's very much a Bungay poem, which is where we are now, where I live, and I was walking around Bungay and there's loads of houses you can tell that used to be pubs.
Yeah,
and I found out that subsequently that there have been 40 different pubs in Bungay over the years.
40?
Yeah, and at sometimes over 20 bloody operating hell. At one time.
That's crazy. And, like, and
it started, yeah, it was only 5,000 people now, and it would have been less than that. So the temperance movement was the beginning of the end. And that was around about the time of the First World War. But yeah, even up until about 20 years ago, there were 10 pubs in Bungay, and there are now 4.
Wow.
I know, right? So I started walking around town. I was thinking, again, I'd just written a univocalism. Maybe I'd written Bert Up Pub, an early version of it. Or, I don't know. I think I'd written that O univocalism. And I had the idea of vowels in my head. And so I had this phrase, houses that used to be boozers. And I thought, that's got a lovely essence to it. I thought, I've got to write something like that. And so I started trying to write this poem. And again, you'll see it's very, very tightly rhymed and in a real galloping sort of rhythm. And I didn't think I'd be able to keep it up, but I managed to anyway. So, yeah. Is for all the lost boozers of Blighty.
And this is, you've got a different book out.
This is from Mondeo Man. This is from the first book that I did. This came out. This is the last thing I wrote for that book. So I wrote this poem in late 2012. Houses that used to be boozers. This town is a stark share of repossessed dark lairs of houses that used to be boozers. Where once we were drinking, we're now slowly sinking in sofas the colour of bruises. Ex-sawdust saloons and our minimalist rooms where every night somebody chooses to rest their behind and half silence their mind in a slow death of sweaty neck snoozers in a tap drip of box sets and docks. But these houses, they used to be buzzing, they used to be busting and splitting and spitting and right. These places, they used to be tasteless, they used to be graceless and legless and feckless each night. Down lopsided streets, factory workers would meet in these houses that used to be boozers and wash the week's slog and the honeydew grog of their bawdy and dubious ruses. Now ladies frizz hair in the glade plug and air of these houses that used to be boozers. So far from the funk of the blood, sweat and spunk when these houses were floozy-filled boozers, when these houses were ringing with song. And I long for the throng of the song we thrived in these dives with their ligging and frigging and dirt, these hell holes where black-hearted arseholes with poor souls and sing and kick heads in till everything hurt. Farewell, Rose and Crown, for the ship has gone down. She's no more for rum-infused cruises. The mad horse and dray is not bucking today. No, he's muzzled as McIntyre muses. And clatters of pewter are taps on computer in houses that used to be boozers. Humdrum sobriety, there's no society. Houses that used to be boozers. In cordoned off hush, we are turning to mush in these houses that used to be boozers. We're fingering phones and we're drinking alone in these houses that used to be, houses that used to be, houses that used to be boozers.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, man.
Pleasure.
Thank you for having me in your home, spending some time, and Where can people catch up with you? What's your website?
Lukewright.co.uk. Well, just Google me. I'm not the cricketer. I'm the other one. And I'm easy to find, and all my gigs are on there. And I say I'll be at Glastonbury and Latitude and Port Elliot, and Festival Number 6, but also for a month up in Edinburgh at the Fringe, and also doing some stuff at the Book Festival as well. So busy summer, you know, it's about, fuck knows, I don't know, about 50 gigs in between now and September. So excellent. Catch me on those.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, man.
Pleasure.
Really nerded out to that. I this is going to be one of the ones that I am going to enjoy listening back in the editing process. So I don't really listen back to my own show because that would be a bit sort of big-headed and narcissistic. But I have to listen to elements as I put in the links up on Acast, and as I'm doing some editing and stuff like that with Rob, you know. So I'm definitely going to listen to this one back because I want to relive that moment. I really just enjoyed it. It was really nice of him to do it. And yeah, it was lovely to be invited up to his home on a day off. The guy works incredibly hard, and he had a day off. It was the day of voting, and you know, he had things to do, and he carved out a couple of hours to meet me, and I'm really, really grateful. If you did enjoy that, and I'm pretty sure you're gonna enjoy it because he's one of the best writers that we've got at the moment, and people like Metro newspapers, they've called him, you know, performance poetry's key revivalist, because his writing is so fantastic. He's definitely one of this generation's greatest storytellers. And aside from the poetry, he's done a couple of one-man shows. They're verse plays. He's got two of them. The first one that won loads and loads of awards is going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year, which it's August the 1st today, so in 2 days I think that starts, and you can get tickets for that. You can get all the details on Luke Wright's website, so go and check that out and book tickets for one of his shows. And I say one because, like I said, he works really, really hard, and he's got two shows at the Fringe Festival, so he's performing every day from the 3rd. And he's going right through August, and I think the last day is like the 27th of August. So every day, twice a day, pretty much, I think he's going to be doing shows. So the first show that he did, his first sort of verse play rather than just straight up poetry, was What I Learned from Johnny Bevan, and it's a fantastic show. And he's doing sort of a dozen dates or 10 dates or so. So go and see that and enjoy that. But his new show is looking pucker, and it's called Frankie Var, and I'm definitely going to go and catch it because it sounds awesome. I'm not going to go into loads of details about what it's about. I just think go and check out the promo bits and stuff on Luke's website. Have a look at what else he's got. Buy one of his books. They're all on there. The Toll's fantastic. You know, you've heard a couple of poems from him today. He did ones that I hadn't really heard him perform, which was really nice, really cool for me. He didn't perform all of the ones that I would say are my favourites. I went with a copy of his book, with about 20 post-it notes, and sort of said, you know, I was going through the book thinking, oh, what ones can I ask him to do? And I'd stuck post-it notes on my favourites, and I'd actually marked about half of them. And he did some ones that I hadn't heard him perform, so that was even better, really. But get his book. If you're into poetry, if you're into writing, the way he constructs sentences, the way he performs them is just fantastic. You know, the expression in his face, he really acts out these stories. Seriously, I'm nerding out now. It's like 5 minutes of me basically blowing smoke up his ass, but I think he's fantastic, and I'm really, really touched that he carved out that time in his day to speak to me. So lukewright.co.uk, he's at Edinburgh all this month, so go and check him out. He's also oh no, that's it, because that date's gone. I'm just looking at his website as we speak, so by the time this comes out, that date will be gone. So yeah, he's doing a hard slog at Edinburgh, and then there's no other gigs up there at the moment. No doubt he'll be back to it within a couple of weeks, probably take a couple of weeks off and do it. I know he's just done Latitude Festival, and he co-produces that show, so or co-produces and curates the poetry at Latitude. So he's a hard worker, check him out for sure. Waffling on as usual, I've just recorded with Rob, who's the producer and editor of this show, so he puts all the audio and makes it sound good. It was a really good one. He literally just left my house. He came round, and I decided to stick him on the microphone, because he's someone that I've known for a while, and that was cool, because I didn't really know a lot about him other than he's been sort of like a Facebook friend, and you know, but we've really started to get to know each other since he's started producing the podcast, and he's an exciting guy. He's a cool guy, and we just sat down, and yeah, I don't know when that episode's going to come out, probably in a couple of weeks, but watch out for that one, because it got good. We had a really nice conversation, and it was difficult for him, and when you listen to it, you'll see why. That's it for me. Check out my website and all the social medias on there, thatmrchristopher.com. Thanks, guys.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.